This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, black cats, bad luck, or good friends? Our next guest tells us about the symbolism of black cats and why superstitions built up around them in past centuries. First, the attorney general's race is commanding less attention than this year's campaigns in Wisconsin for governor and U.S. Senate. But the state's attorney general is poised to shape issues ranging from abortion rights to voter access. As Sarah Lear reports, Democrat Josh Call is trying to keep his seat by framing the race as a fight to protect freedoms.
We won't go back. We won't go back.
We won't back down. At a Planned Parenthood rally in Middleton earlier this month, the theme of the evening was taking control. Attorney General Josh Call told supporters that Wisconsinites lost control over their health care decisions when Republican lawmakers refused to repeal a 19th century law that bans abortions except those done to save a pregnant person's life. And the crowd booed when Call described how legislators blocked a plan by Governor Tony Evers to amend the Constitution so voters could eventually overturn the ban by statewide referendum. But Call, who's running for re-election, says Wisconsinites can still exercise choice on November 8th.
The stakes in this midterm election could not be bigger. Reproductive freedom is on the ballot.
Call's suing in an attempt to get a judge to block Wisconsin's abortion ban. In the meantime, he promises not to charge providers under the law. That's in contrast to Call's Republican challenger, Fond du Lac County District Attorney Eric Toney, who says he would enforce it. Call, the son of former Wisconsin Attorney General Peg Lautenschlager, won his last race 4 years ago by less than a percentage point. Paul Nolet, who teaches political science at Marquette University, expects another very close election. He says it could come down to a fight for focus.
Which of the candidates and which of the campaigns is able to fight on the ground that they're most comfortable with?
Like other Republicans across the country, Tony has focused on crime. And as Nolet observes, Call keeps talking about abortion rights.
He really wants to make this a referendum on, as he kind of puts it, you know, the nature of freedom here in Wisconsin. So thinking about like reproductive rights, freedom, and the freedom of the vote.
Call pledges to prosecute threats against election workers, and as AG, he fought attempts by Republicans to overturn the 2020 election results. He's also been a reliable ally to Evers. That includes defending the Democratic governor's COVID-19 mandates and siding with him in legal disputes over the boundaries of Wisconsin's new political districts. Tony, meanwhile, accuses Call of mismanagement at the Department of Justice's Division of Criminal Investigation, known as the DCI. He points to staff vacancies and a slowdown in evidence processing at the agency.
We need an attorney general that's actually going to make public safety the top priority and clean up the mess that Josh Call has created at our Department of Justice, at our crime labs, our prosecutors, and DCI.
Call says he expects to be at full staffing by the end of the year. And he says analysts are becoming more efficient at handling increasingly complex cases, despite underfunding from the Republican-led legislature. Tony has also been trying to paint Call as soft on crime, an accusation that Call says is absurd. He cites his time as an assistant U.S. attorney in Baltimore.
I was a federal prosecutor in one of the most violent cities in the country, and I prosecuted murderers, drug traffickers, and gang members.
Call has used the spotlight of the attorney general's office to push for gun control, and he's decried what he's described as attacks on voting rights and reproductive choice. Other campaigns are grabbing more attention than his, but Call is trying to remind voters that they still have a big choice when it comes to the race for attorney general. Sarah Lear, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Tomorrow at this time, we'll hear a news feature about challenger Eric Toney, and we'll talk to the candidates here on Central Time tomorrow and Wednesday at 4 p.m. Now, the U.S. Supreme Court heard oral arguments today in two cases involving affirmative action in higher education. The cases have been brought against Harvard University and the University of North Carolina, arguing that they should not be allowed to consider race as a factor in college admissions. The challengers say these policies have led to discrimination against white and Asian American students when applying to those colleges. The universities say that race is just one factor among many in their admissions process, and they fear that without affirmative action, the diversity of their enrollment would decrease significantly. They argue that a more diverse student population boosts the educational experience. Want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you think colleges should consider race as a factor in student applications? If so, how? Do you think it's important to have a diverse student population on a campus? Call 800-642-1234 with your thoughts or your questions. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Tanya Washington Hicks is a professor of law at Georgia State University. Her research and scholarship focuses on issues related to educational equity, domestic relations, race, and children's constitutional rights. She co-authored an amicus brief cited by Justice Anthony Kennedy in the Obergefell marriage equality case in 2015. Tanya, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, can we set the stage with the previous ruling from the U.S. Supreme Court, I think going back to 2003. Can you set the stage for us with what happened, what came out of that?
Yes, that was the first time in a case called Grutter versus Bollinger. It was the first time that the Supreme Court actually embraced racial diversity, which is one aspect of educational diversity, as a constitutionally compelling goal. And absent a constitutional compelling goal, the use of race is unconstitutional. So for the first time in that case, citing a 1978 case called Bakke, the U.S. Supreme Court, in an opinion authored by Justice O'Connor, recognized that educational diversity, the educational benefits that are derived from having racial diversity in a classroom, do serve a compelling constitutional goal. The court also said that the pursuit of that goal must be narrowly tailored to that end. And the court kind of restricted the way in which race could be used. In a companion case, also out of University of Michigan, Gratz, the Gratz case, the court said that every applicant has to be independently assessed and compete with every other applicant in order for race to be constitutionally used. And so in those companion cases, both out of the University of Michigan, one, Gratz was undergrad, Grutter was the law school context. The court issued differing opinions. The use of race in Grutter to serve the constitutional compelling interest of educational diversity was found to be constitutional. The use of race in the Gratz case, because the court said it was not sufficiently individualized, was deemed unconstitutional. So that's kind of where we were up until today. There were some other cases, Fisher 1 and Fisher 2 out of the University of Texas, in which the court affirmed its decision in Grutter, recognizing that educational diversity, of which racial diversity is but one important aspect, is still a constitutional compelling goal. And where we are now is we're waiting to see whether the court will reaffirm Grutter or whether it will overrule Grutter.
Let's hear some of the oral arguments in the case. Here's attorney Patrick Strawbridge, who argues that race-based admissions violates the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment.
There are many factors in an application like that that might be appropriate to consider, including if they are first-generation college or including if they are socioeconomically depressed. But if the only difference is between a white student and a black student, I don't think the Equal Protection Clause permits the admissions decision to hinge on that.
Can you talk a little more about that argument?
Well, he referenced the Equal Protection Clause, which is the 14th Amendment, portion of the 14th Amendment in the U.S. Constitution, under which uses of race will be scrutinized with a very exacting test called strict scrutiny. And unless the goal that one is pursuing is not determined to be constitutionally compelling, and if the means of achieving that goal are not narrowly tailored, then the use of race will be deemed unconstitutional. Race is special in this regard. It is subject to strict scrutiny because the court recognizes our storied history as a nation with racial discrimination. And so any use of race will be viewed with a jaundiced eye, if you will. And so comparing it to other considerations like socioeconomic concerns, geography, those are not special categories or suspect classifications. And so the use of those of considerations that are based on socioeconomic status or geography are not going to be subject to the same kind of constitutional scrutiny as uses of race will. But I do want to highlight that the use of race is not automatically unconstitutional under the 14th Amendment. Its use must serve a compelling constitutional goal, and it must be in service of that goal using means that are narrowly tailored to that end. And that's where application of the test will frame kind of the court's consideration. The question will be whether the court will continue to recognize educational diversity, of which racial diversity is but one aspect, as a constitutionally compelling goal. If it decides that it's not, then any use of race would be offensive to the 14th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution and would be deemed unconstitutional.
And on the other side, here's North Carolina Solicitor General Ryan Y. Park arguing in favor of the affirmative action practices at the University of North Carolina.
A racially diverse and a diverse diversity of all kinds leads to, quote, a deeper and richer learning environment, leads to more creative thinking and exchange of ideas, and critically reduced bias between people of different backgrounds and not solely different racial backgrounds.
So there's that educational benefit for all the students argument that defenders of these policy are making.
Absolutely. And I'm so glad you chose that quote. It responds to Justice Thomas's persistent questioning throughout almost 5 hours of oral argument. For someone to state precisely what the educational benefit is of racial diversity. And as a professor of more than 20 years, I can speak to that. The enhanced learning environment that was highlighted in the quote that you played is very important. When you have people in a classroom who are coming to a subject matter from not just different viewpoints, but different experiential points, meaning they've had different experiences that frame their understanding, their interpretation of a particular concept or idea, you get a more synergistic and dynamic learning space versus a more homogeneous space where everyone is coming to the subject matter from the same set of experiences. And so the idea of educational diversity as distinguished from remedial focused diversity, is to take advantage of the racial disparities and the different racial experiences that different racial groups have in America by virtue of our history with race. And to bring that to bear in the learning space, which enhances higher order thinking, problem solving, analytical analysis, all of that is informed and greatly enhanced when you have racial heterogeneity in the classroom. And that's kind of the underpinnings of the educational diversity argument.
We're talking to Georgia State University law professor Tanya Washington Hicks about U.S. Supreme Court arguments earlier today over affirmative action as part of college admissions. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think it should be a goal of college campuses to have a diverse student body, including steps to make sure it's racially diverse on a particular college campus? If you have questions about these arguments before the U.S. Supreme Court, call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk with Tanya Washington Hicks, law professor at Georgia State University, with us today to examine the arguments in a case before the U.S. Supreme Court about affirmative action in college admissions. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Robbie is with us in Marinette. Robbie, hi.
Hi there. How are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
So I just think that we have universities and higher education, they have a moral responsibility to make sure that their populations are diverse by nature. I don't think that it's going to be deemed constitutional, though, because they're going about the wrong way. You see, it needs to be deemed constitutional because we're giving people an opportunity to spend money. It's not a business denying an employee. It's a business allowing certain customers in. And that's why I think it should be deemed constitutional. I just don't think it's going to go that way, unfortunately.
Robbie, thanks for the call. Robbie thinks it should happen. Tanya thinks it won't. I won't ask you to predict outcomes, but what is your read on what the members of the court said today?
Well, I think Robbie makes an outstanding point in terms of moral responsibility, but that would be keyed more toward the remedial use of affirmative action. But it also speaks to something that was a theme throughout the oral argument today about the zero-sum game zero-sum game nature of college admissions, right? I think Harvard said they get over 60,000 applications for 1,600 slots. So by definition of those numbers, the reality is most people who apply to Harvard, white, Black, Asian, Indigenous, Latino, are not going to be admitted. That's just the hard reality. And so the idea that that Harvard is trying to create a class that is going to give rise to kind of the analysis, the higher order thinking, is a really profound justification. But there's another justification that speaks to kind of the moral responsibility. We want our classrooms to look like our country. We want to make sure that our professional class that relies on diverse members of our society obtaining undergraduate and graduate school degrees so that we'll have Black judges and Latino doctors and Indigenous teachers. We need to have diverse undergraduate institutions if we're going to have a diverse professional class. And if we want, for purposes of our pluralistic democracy, to ensure that people of have confidence that the system, that they are represented in the system by which they will be governed, that all requires that we have diverse learning spaces. And so I think his point is well taken, but I also agree with his pessimistic outlook that that affirmative action is not likely to survive this constitutional challenge.
Robbie, thanks for that call. Matt joins us now in Madison. Matt, hi.
Hello. I think it's long past time for affirmative action to go. Choosing who gets to attend a school based on their race is no different than choosing who gets to go to a restaurant or who gets to go to the department store. If we're only going to allow a certain number of a particular race into a business, that's inherently racist. And you're never going to end the idea of questioning whether somebody got their degree because of the color of their skin versus the integrity and knowledge that they bring to the profession. You're never going to end this. Universities should be blind to color and name. You apply based on every other demographic, but they don't get to see your name. They don't get to see your race. And then you can be assured that the people that are graduating got there based on their merits and not based on the color of their skin.
Matt, thanks for the call. Tanya?
Yes, Matt speaks to the meritocracy, which maybe up until 3 or 4 years ago, I think would have been a more persuasive argument. But the Operation Varsity Blues scandal, which revealed that wealthy, generally white parents were paying for pictures of their children to be photoshopped on to the crew team, for instance, and they were getting athletic scholarships based on this fraudulent representation of their extracurricular involvement, and they were paying for people to take standardized tests to get perfect scores that were then attributed to their children, despite the fact that the children didn't earn those scores. So this has been going on for some time, which calls into question, and I think really undermines the myth of the meritocracy, that people who are in these or attending these Ivy League institutions are there only by virtue of their performance or their competencies. I also think that, and his comment referenced this, legacy admits, which I guess you would eliminate if you eliminate the name of the person as part of the application. Legacy admits kind of lock in privilege, because at a lot of these universities, there was an overt policy of racial discrimination that prohibited Latinx, Black, Indigenous, and other people of color from ever attending those institutions, which means that their descendants cannot qualify for legacy admissions. And so we have a lot of policies that are rooted in racial realities that advantage people in the applicant pool. But the way that affirmative action is framed in the public eye is that it's giving people a leg up, when in reality, absent affirmative action policies, we would be left with kind of our historic and continuing practice of discriminating against people of color and working class white folks who are often kind of left out of the conversation. We need our universities to be able to consider race so that they can create the most diverse group of students so that they can capture that intellectual and educational yield that benefits every student in the classroom.
Matt, thanks for that call. In our last minute or so, Tanya, is this just about colleges and universities, or could a ruling in this case have effects outside of higher education?
That's a great question. And it makes me think about Brown versus Board of Education, which was decided in 1954, in which many of the justices referenced today and asserted for different propositions with respect to how this these cases should be resolved. Just like Brown had an impact beyond just K through 12, it helped to desegregate other spaces in our society. This decision will have the reverse effect if the court does not uphold the constitutional use of race in admissions. I think we will see in employment sectors, in housing sectors, in a number of different contexts, we will see the government pushing back on the consideration of race and the use of race to achieve equity. And I think that's going to be problematic for our society and for our democracy.
Tanya, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. This was an enlightening conversation, and I appreciate all your callers for calling in.
That's Tanya Washington Hicks, professor of law at Georgia State University, with us today to look at a case argued earlier today before the U.S. Supreme Court challenging affirmative action. Two cases, actually, in college admissions. Still time for you to weigh in with your thoughts. You can email ideas@WPR.org and head over to WPR.org for some coverage from our friends over at NPR. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, if you don't have sleep apnea, there's a really good chance you know somebody who does. The sleep disorder affects millions of people in the United States. Kate's guest will share some of the causes and the consequences of sleep apnea, plus take a look at treatments and solutions. And if this is affecting your life, they can tackle your questions. Email now, ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Then tune in tomorrow morning at 8. That's here on the Ideas Network. On last week's edition of Food Friday, Wisconsin food writer Jennifer Rude Klett joined the show with some seasonal and simple foods that use local fall produce. Well, we asked what you were cooking lately. Some of you shared your favorite fall foods during the show and some on the Ideas Network Facebook page. James says a lentil and vegetable soup. And James, Jennifer was right there with you on the lentils. That's one of the recipes she shared with us, a French lentil soup that she promised wasn't going to be too fancy. You can find it, plus a couple others, at WPR.org/Food Friday. And Jacqueline wrote that she was making a yam apple cranberry dish with a maple syrup, orange juice, ginger spiced sauce. Sounds pretty good for Thanksgiving, too. Now, I was inspired to make one of my favorite fall foods, a squash soup. Can't really share the recipe, though. For this soup, I have a special ingredient. There's a Thai restaurant I like. The main dish I get there comes with a lot of extra yellow curry broth. I save it, use it as a key ingredient in the soup. Came out great. Is that cheating? If so, I don't care. It's food news you can use. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, keep listening if you dare. We talk with Wisconsin's own paranormal researcher, Chad Lewis, about supernatural dares of the Midwest. Now, if you've ever seen a black cat and decided to go the other way, you were part of a superstition that goes back a long time. You most likely know that black cats are often recognized as a symbol of bad luck during Halloween, often associated with witches. But where does that come from? Simon Bronner is the Dean of the College of General Studies and Distinguished Professor of Social Sciences at UW-Milwaukee. He's the author of the Encyclopedia of American Folklife. Simon, welcome back to Central Time.
Great to be here. Thank you.
How far back does superstition about cats, and I guess black cats in particular, really go?
We know that it shows up in Greek mythology, certainly, with the figure of Hecate, who was shown as the goddess of magic and sorcery, and she often had a pet of a black cat, and that was not only in oral tradition, but in visual culture as well.
Now, how about medieval Europe? That's when, I guess, if I thought, okay, our modern superstition goes back that far, it's probably something in Christian medieval Europe. What kind of things do we see there?
Well, Christianity has a lot to do with it, particularly in Europe, in the transition from paganism to Christianity. And the Catholic Church was trying to separate itself from the animism of the time. So there's actually a declaration that we have by Pope Gregory in 1233 with a whole bestiary that was connected with evil. And one of the biggest culprits was black cat, because that was supposed to be the incarnation of the devil.
I have had a black cat who, you know, would pounce on my feet while I was sleeping. I didn't think it was associated with the devil or anything. What is it about cats in particular, you think, that put them on that bestiary of evil?
Well, there are a lot of theories about that. Feminists would argue the association of black cats with witches and with older women was one of the signs that they were independent and marginalized and not in the family norm, and therefore they were often accused of witchcraft with this associated cat that was there, certainly. Another aspect is just that the connection with the night and the contrast of the day, which is supposed to be good, and the night and the association with forests and the nocturnal and the supernatural as a result of that.
And I understand cats got a really bad rap during the era of the Black Plague.
Yes, there was the mistaken belief that they were spreading the bubonic plague, partly because they were independent and would roam around. So it was one of the theories there, and black cats were burned ceremoniously and killed, even though that doing that actually helped spread the bubonic plague, because it was the rats that were actually the carriers. But the rats were not as visible, and the black cats were.
Now, in the modern day, I think mostly the suspicion about black cats has gone away, but we still kind of, in our fun celebrations of Halloween, carry on that tradition of the black cat in the imagery. Can you talk about how that may have been, I guess, tamed over the centuries?
Well, sure. You should know that there's an American connection, because the Puritans were especially hostile to black cats, carrying on this idea of the reincarnation of the devil and also the association with witches. But in the late 19th century, postcards came in, greeting cards came in, and lithographs. And one of the ways to depict Halloween as a fun kind of celebration and not just a time when all the evil spirits are released is to show the black cats, often with orange caps and often with yellow or green eyes, which was another aspect, even though that's relatively rare among cats. And that continued on with the celebration of candies as well, and the use of cats at that time. But I should point out that some of that has arguably been in decline with the rise of spiders, partly because cats have a more positive image today than they probably did previously. Maybe all those cat memes have something to do with it.
And you also mentioned the Halloween candy. And yeah, I have an arsenal of candy at home that I'm hoping to hand out tonight and not eat quite so much of. How did candy end up being such a central part of Halloween?
Well, trick-or-treating was not all about the getting of sweets. And there's an argument that municipalities and communities wanted to get away from the trick, the mischief, the pranks that would often be occurring, and have a different way to tame it down. And this idea of actually trying to bribe children by giving them candy started to come into vogue. And there has been an argument that the candy companies, which were not having an easy time because candies were perishable, of selling them, and they encouraged and promoted the use of the candies as the treat that would be given out at Halloween time.
Simon, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
My pleasure. Have a happy Halloween.
You too. That's Simon Bronner, Dean of the College of General Studies and Distinguished Professor of Social Sciences at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. He joins us today for a look at some Halloween folklore, including the symbolism behind black cats. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a spooky story for Halloween.
If you ask around, you'll likely hear that ghosts are lurking on UW-Madison's historic campus, from things like the very real graves atop Bascom Hill to generations of student lore. Many have reported that the history here sometimes goes bump in the night. WPR's A. Emily Ralph explores the intersection of history and rumor in one of the university's oldest buildings.
11:55. Enough time for one more story. One more story before 12, just to keep us warm.
Okay, so rumor has it on campus that Science Hall was the medical building, and the doctors and med students would work on cadavers, but the morgue was in the basement, and a lot of the laboratories were upstairs. Before they had elevators, they used to transport cadavers up and down through dumbwaiters in the walls. Rumor has it that they lost a couple bodies. The other thing that I heard was that there was a mad professor whose office was kind of in the attic, and he did crazy experiments up there, and everything is still set up to this day with the labels on the drawers and beakers. This drawer's for fingers, that drawer's for toes, and everything's just very creepy. But that's a fun myth that people like to tell about Science Hall.
That's Brittany Williams, UW grad and former director of engineering at WPR, recorded back when she was a student. The best ghost stories are the ones where so much of them is true. I don't know about the mad professor, but the rest is dead on. As recently as the 1970s, students were still finding human remains around the building. Over the years, people have reported feeling a presence or suddenly smelling strong odors of blood or formaldehyde. Ghost or not, Science Hall is an imposing building, standing like a Gothic red brick fortress guarding the heart of campus. The old anatomy labs were on the fourth floor, and that's supposed to be the most haunted part of the building. It's definitely creepy, but I'm more interested in rumors of secret labs and mad scientists in the attic. Building manager Jim Miller gave me and a few grad students the tour.
Hello.
Hi.
I'm Marion.
At first glance, it looks like any other big old attic. Dusty, full of boxes, and a floor where a misstep could be pretty bad. Then we turn a corner and things get weird. The place is kind of set up like a lab, with the remains of sinks or workstations, maybe. A cabinet full of missing drawers still has some labels on it.
Yeah, it says meat slicer extras. That's what I bet I'm
thinking. It gets better, though. In the room off that, shelves have big labels indicating where to keep your chemicals and...
Head holders.
Head holders? I don't know what a head holder is, but I'm hoping the meat slicer extras aren't involved. As cool as all this is, there's another dimension here, and that's up.
It's got a letter to my mom in it.
Okay, we'll make sure she gets it if something happens.
We climb a series of ladders and platforms all the way to the peak of the building's top tower. The floor is about the size of a picnic table, and here we find one last mystery. Two chairs, a deck of cards, and a can of Skull. At least the ghosts obey the no smoking policy. They have an amazing view, too. Metal vents in the roof slide open, and the whole city stretches out before you. I didn't see anything supernatural, but I wanted to. I keep my eyes open in the dark. Maybe one day I'll meet the ghost with a taste for heights and chewing tobacco.
WPR's senior spooky correspondent, A. Emily Ralph, with a story on UW-Madison's Science Hall. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lola Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, a Wisconsin paranormal researcher tells us where some of the freakiest dares around the state are and what happens when you complete them. That's next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Now, what if I said Bloody Mary three times fast? Well, nothing. I'm not in front of a mirror, so that doesn't count. I'm not in front of a bartender, so I won't get three drinks. Repeating something three times, though, is often part of the ritual of completing a supernatural dare, according to our next guest, and he'd know. He's done a lot of them. Eau Claire's own Chad Lewis is a paranormal researcher and legend tripper. He's the author of more than 25 books on the supernatural, including one of his most recent called Supernatural Dares of the Midwest, Curses, Monsters, and Ghosts. Chad, welcome back to Central Time.
Happy Halloween to you.
And to you, Chad. Great to talk to you on Halloween, of all days in particular. Now, that Bloody Mary thing I mentioned, like most, a lot of school kids anyway have heard of this. You say Bloody Mary three times, mirror, dark, ghost appears. You write about a lot of location-specific dares. Why are there so many of these things out there?
People are itching for the unique and bizarre, that they want to get away from the same restaurants, hotels, businesses that they see, and they want to go out, and believe it or not, they want to get scared. Being scared is fun when it's in a controlled manner, like going to a scary movie or riding a roller coaster, you know. You're probably going to survive, but there's that iffy part as well.
And you, as always, are seeking out local legends. And when you go to a community with some of the specific dares, this is something that a lot of people know about, right? They know if you go to this place and do this thing, do X, Y is going to happen. These are part of local folklore.
These places really have become a rite of passage. So many people tell me that when they were in high school, the thing to do was just to go out to the legend area and complete the dare. Try to test your bravery. See if you can sit on a mausoleum or cursed chair longer than your friend. So it was really something passed from generation to generation that everybody in the community knew about and participated in.
Let's check out some of the specific ones. Now, this is interesting. I was flipping through, of course, looking for the Wisconsin ones in particular. Three of them happen on bridges: the Bloody Bride Bridge in Stevens Point, Blood-Soaked Bridge in Lowell, and Weary Road in Evansville. What's the deal with bridges in Wisconsin, Chad?
Great point. I could have done an entire book on bridge dares, but many people believe that much like bridges in our world connect water with land, they hold a power in the spirit world, a significance of connecting our world with the spirit world. And plus, water plays a big part into folklore. It's where a lot of our ancestors came over and lived by the water. So their stories came with them, the non-Indigenous ones. So water and bridges combined seem to make a perfect area for weird things to happen.
Okay, so let's go to Point, Stevens Point, and the Bloody Bride Bridge. What is the dare? What is the story around it?
Story is, many years ago, a young woman died on her wedding night coming home. She bled to death waiting for help to arrive. And now unsuspecting motorists have seen this woman walking on the bridge, often appearing like maybe she needs help or broke down, needs some assistance. But when people slow down, she simply either vanishes into thin air or is not there at all. But the dare is that if you're brave enough, or foolish enough to park your car on the bridge, when you look into your back mirror, not only will you see the ghost of this bloody bride, but many witnesses told me that she'll actually be sitting right in your back seat while you're parked there.
Okay, now this is bringing back a Twilight Zone memory of an episode I saw too early, but I'll power through. You are both brave and foolhardy, Chad. You did this and most of the other dares in your book, right?
I'm self-proclaiming myself as the Guinness World Record holder for doing the most supernatural dares. I've done hundreds of them. So I'm at the point, Rob, now that if anything bad, mishap, misfortune, or death happens to me, I wouldn't know what dare to blame it on.
And that's another thing. Some of these dares aren't like, if you do this, something bad is going to happen while you do it. Some of them are, you know, the spirit will appear or whatever. Some of them are, if you do it, misfortune will come to you at some point in the near future, right?
99% of these dares around the world are negative. It's hardly ever anything. If you do the dare, you're going to find true love or win the lottery. It's always you'll be in a car accident, lose your job, break up with your significant others, all kinds of just terrible ill fate and harbingers of bad, ill future for you. So I always encourage people, do these at your own risk.
Talking to Chad Lewis, one of his most recent books is Supernatural Dares of the Midwest, Curses, Monsters, and Ghosts. Yeah, and this is something, I think of this as mainly a teenage sort of thing to do, and everybody's egging each other on, and, you know, are you chicken, whatever. I think, though, you did encounter one, a mausoleum-related dare where a 70-year-old woman told you she gave it a shot.
Yes, you'd be mistaken thinking this is just teenagers. A woman was 70 years old sitting up on a haunted mausoleum where the legend is you'll be shoved to the ground, which is over 6.5 feet up. So she was taking the dare, and luckily for us anyway, she was not pushed. But I had a woman outside of Madison in Evansville go to Weary Road and claim that she saw this giant, big wolf-like creature with glowing yellow eyes as she parked on the bridge and felt this thing was going to harm her. So we often think of it being high school age or college age kids going out there with their imagination. But often it runs the entire spectrum of curious people.
And you hit the books and the vintage newspapers to try to track down, you know, did these legends happen or what were some of the earliest reports of them? Can you talk a little bit about the historical research you do?
Like all good legends, many of the origins are unknown. Sometimes the decade is not even known. There's a goat man that is said to roam Marsh Road outside of New London, dating back to at least the 1950s, probably earlier, but there's no real account of it. So sometimes that's very difficult when you're trying to sort fact from fiction and trying to find, is there an origin story to this? And sometimes there is, but it may be embellished or just been wrongly placed over the years. Sometimes you'll talk to seniors in an area. They'll tell you one version of a legend. You talk to high schoolers, they have a completely different version, as though over the decades, the folklore has played a game of telephone.
You took up every dare in the book except one, a bonus one you give at the end, but not for lack of trying. Can you talk about the mysterious book that will kill you in Whitewater, Wisconsin?
So the Whitewater Library, in some versions it's the public, others it's the university, has a book under lock and key that if you check this book out, it's a book of the dead. You will die either by a tragic accident or your own hand. And I joke that I don't know who keeps returning the book, but that's the legend. And every year the librarians tell me, don't talk about this. We don't have the book. Don't send people here, which is exactly what you would expect those sneaky librarians to tell you. So I've spoken at both the Whitewater Public and University Library, and I love bringing it up to the librarians because they think it's a fun story. And even the local university paper said that over a dozen faculty and staff have died from checking this out with students as well, and that you'll be expelled if you even try to check it out, which you will not. So I always just tell people, go there, just make sure you have someone set up to return it when you meet your fate.
Excellent. And Chad, some dares are timing specific. Are there any good Halloween day or Halloween night ones?
Yes, especially as the goat man I mentioned, because it's also on Marsh Road that it is thought to be haunted by some homecoming royalty, a king and queen who took their own lives out there many years ago. And it was during homecoming week, the week of Halloween. So if you go out there, it is said you're more likely to experience it tonight than any other day of the year.
Chad, we'll leave it there. Thanks as always for joining us today.
Keep an eye out.
Eau Claire's own Chad Lewis is a paranormal researcher and legend tripper. We talked to them today about one of his latest books, Supernatural Dares of the Midwest, Curses, Monsters, and Ghosts, as we mark Halloween. Chad has several free speaking engagements coming up in Wisconsin. He'll talk about winter legends and lore this Wednesday at 6:30 p.m. at the Sun Prairie Public Library, Thursday at 6:30 at the Delafield Public Library. Hey, if you have a local legend of a dare or other supernatural nature to share, let us know about it. We can pass along to Chad. He's probably heard about it, but maybe not. Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Did you do one of these as a teenager or a 70-year-old? Email ideas@WPR.org and let us know. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, inflation is still kind of high. Unemployment is still pretty low. So how is the economy doing? We're going to check in on the state of the U.S. economy and what it means for you, and you can call in and tell us how it's going for you. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.